In this podcast, we're going to do some magazine reading from the Cosmos Winter 2017 Science Magazine, The Science of Everything. This is general practice in terms of speaking and articulation. And we're just going to go through the very short articles at the front. This first article is by Andrew Masterton, and it's The Belly of the Beasts. After weight loss surgery, the gut microbiome can fail to flourish, Andrew Masterson reports. Gastric bypass surgery permanently changes the makeup of the microbial communities in the gut, new research shows. Previous studies have established that obesity is linked to reduced diversity of the gut microbe species, which has a negative impact on health, because the bacteria of our bellies is crucial for efficient digestion. The new study led by Zahar Esra Iham and Rosa Kajeminlink Brown of Arizona State University in the US set out to determine the effects on microbial diversity of two popular weight loss procedures, Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, RYGB, and the laparoscopic adjustment gastric banding, LAGB. RYGB is the more aggressive intervention and is irreversible. The team discovered that after weight loss prompted by the bypass surgery, most patients' gut microbiota underwent profound changes. The new bacterial ecology was different to those of both obese and normal weight people, but it was also highly diverse, a sign of an efficient system. Diversity is good because of what we call functional redundancy. If you have 10 workers that can do the same job, when one of them gets sick, the job still gets done, Kajamilink Brown notes. Gastric bypass surgery is an effective long-term weight loss strategy for obese or morbidly obese people. However, it doesn't work in every case, with some patients continuing to gain weight after the operation. Ehan suspects this may reflect a failure of the gut microbiome to flourish. She suggests that further research might find a way to avoid the invasive, risky procedure, replacing it with a bacteria-friendly infusion. A probiotic that would replace surgery would be great, she says. The research was published in the ISMA journal, whatever that is. This is the next article. These are short articles. I'm going to read about three or four to get through. Deep space would smell quite bad. If you could smell deep space, it wouldn't be a very pleasant experience at all, Joel F. Hooper reports. So this is quite good because it tells you smell chemicals and stuff like that. Quite a good introduction. Smell is perhaps our most mysterious sense, perhaps because it can trigger memories and link it to us to specific times and places. So it's not surprising that we often wonder what different exotic places would smell like. Think of the frequent mention of the odour in Gulliver Travels or the Professor Farnsworth's smelloscope in Futurama. Thus, setting aside the practical problems of trying to take a lungful of vacuum, what would it be like to get a whiff of the sparse gases and particles that occupy deep space? If I turn our nose to Sagittarius B2, the cloud of gas about 390 light years from the centre of the Milky Way. Okay, it would be good if they gave you the actual dimensions, so it's 50,000 light years and we're at 30,000 light years out. We would encounter a host of olfactory delights. Almost every chemical that has been detected in space can be found here. Among the smelly components of Sagittarius B2 is hydrogen sulfide, it should be dihydrogen sulfide, H2S, often described as a rotten S or fart gas. This chemical can be detected in around 10 billion molecules per cubic centimetre by the human nose and can cause death in high concentrations. At its most dense, Sagittarius cloud contains only about 1 million molecules per cubic centimetre, about 10,000 times beneath the human threshold. We might also encounter hydrogen cyanide, HCM, another deadly gas. Chemists in the early 20th century used to smoke cigarettes while working with this chemical, because the release of hydrogen cyanide would change the flavour of tobacco and act as an early warning sign of any leak. This is great news. This is amazing stuff. Great. There is also much more agreeable odours in space. Ethyl formate belongs to a class of molecules called esters, which often have a sweet and fruity aroma. It's one of the chemicals responsible for the smell of raspberries. I still gave the formula of ester, carbon with a double bond, oxygen, another carbon, R, carbon with a double bond, oxygen, another R. This is also home to compounds called polyaromatic hydrocarbons, my favourite ones. The aromatic means those rings. Flat molecules made of rings of carbon atoms. These chemicals were named aromatic by early chemists before their structure was known, due to the strong smells they produced. Their fragrances range from faintly pleasant to strong smell of coal tar. A study published recently in the Astrophysical Journal found that they are present in much higher concentrations than previously thought, especially in older galaxies. Well, that's interesting. The main difference between the gases of space and those in our atmosphere is the abundance of oxygen on Earth, meaning that many smelly chemicals based on sulfur and phosphorus exist there in milder, oxidized forms. We must conclude, therefore, that a deep whiff of space gas would probably smell closest to rotting garbage, fish, or flatulence. That was a good article in terms of getting some chemistry out there. Good reading it through. Irons in the fire. The next generation spacecraft engines are a step closer. Andrew Masterson reports. So he's done a couple of articles here. What's he done? He's done the belly and this. It's good. See if this article changes from the first. Iron drives are popular for propelling spacecraft in science fiction, but are rare in the real world because of the bulky engineering required to manage the essential gas propellant. Now researchers from the University of York, Britain, and the École Polytechnique in Paris have taken a major step towards solving the problem. Existing systems use electric current to ionize propellant gas and turn it into plasma. The charged ions and electrons are then forced through the exhaust beam, creating thrust. Current technology, usually in the form known as a gridded ion thruster, generates more positively charged ions than negative ones. While this is useful for moving an object through space, it's also potentially self-defeating. If the charge imbalance remained, the spacecraft would gain a net negative charge with the mission-ending consequences. Now you really have to explain that you create a dipole which collapses. So accelerate for a certain while, but it's sort of like a gigantic rubber band, but this hasn't been explained to him. In order to deal with current spacecraft contain an additional piece of kit called a neutralizer bolted near the exhaust. This generates additional negative ions, ensuring the craft remains electrically neutral. In 2014, a team of École Polytechnique demonstrated a reconfigured grid thruster that would produce equal amounts of positive and negative ions without loss of thrust. The scientists named the system Neptune. Now the French researchers have teamed up with James Derrick and Andrew Gibson of the University of York's Plasma Institute to take the concept to the next stage. In their results reported in Physics in Plasmas, the scientists outlined a highly detailed observation of how Neptune's plasma beam varies according to the location of the particle and particle strength. The findings take the system critical step closer to full development. Okay, quite good, but perhaps you should explain a little bit. Okay, Flora's Hobbit mystery deepens. Its closest relative is 1.75 million years old, African, Elizabeth Finkel reports. This is actually quite good, we're just reading it here. The metre-tall Homo floresiensis, popularly known as the Hobbit, just keeps upending the history of human evolution. The latest chapter, published in the Journal of Human Evolution in April, concludes that its closest relative was Homo habilis, who lived 9,000 kilometres away in Ethiopia. Not only has this left archaeologists scratching their heads, it changes the textbook view that Homo erectus was the first ancient human species to leave Africa. Okay, that's interesting. It was 2003 1903 when Mike Morwood and colleagues first reported the discovery of the papyri bones of H. Florentius, alongside stone tools and sediments of the vast Liang Bo cave in Flores. To Morwood, the bones resembled those of Ethiopia's famous 3.2-million-year-old Australopithecine Lucy. Now, Lucy is something very interesting I read about. I've forgotten what the name of the geologist, but I did read an original book back in the 80s, I think it was, and they were camping. The bones of Lucy. I think Lucy was a footprint. No, the bones, yeah, I think the same people uncovered bipedal footprints, and then they found the bones of Lucy. The bipedal footprints were discovered as they were camping. They just found, and then they found Lucy. So, how could such a primitive hominid species have reached Flores? And they should probably explain that Flores is across the... You've got Borneo, and it's an island across, in Indonesia, across the... something or other line, the... Oh, gone from my head. There's a special line, a biological line, the... Darwin, not going in my head, sorry guys. And how could they have endured until 18,000 years ago? That was the initial date reported for the remains. Rather than accept these mind-boggling propositions, some anthropologists argue that the hobbit was not ancient, but deceased modern human, perhaps afflicted by dwarfism. Okay, I would not say that they're not accepting it, they just say... propose an alternative selection which must be discredited. The position that H. erectus arrived on the island and shrank, just like the Asian elephant that shrank to become Flores dwarf's stegodon. I guess dwarf elephant, it would have helped. The debate has largely gone away, aided by new dating techniques indicating hobbits were a very enduring bunch. Tools remains show that they have occupied the cave from 190,000 to 5,000 years ago. So they were probably there when the Aboriginals came and occupied Australia. The new debate lies with the hobbit's ancestors. Two recent studies concluded that H. erectus, Homo erectus, was the closest relative. And that makes sense. Homo erectus skulls had, after all, been found nearby Java, though not the Flores itself. So Flores has got that deep current, so how do you get across there? Okay. Oh, the... something right the line. Oh, gosh, I wish I'd remember. Oh, God. But a new analysis by Debbie Argue's team, whoever she is, at the National University pushed the pendulum back closer to Lucy, who is the... what is she, Lucy... Okay, we don't know... Okay, we're just reading the pack. It was pre-Homo habilis. Okay, yep, okay. And the current study included 133 data points ranging across skull, jaws, teeth, arms, legs and shoulders. The verdict, as far as descent from Homo erectus, all these tests say it doesn't fit, Argue says. Okay, so Homo erectus is modern... habilis is much older. The inside of Flores's lower jaw was particularly telling. It showed pronounced reinforcing mounds known as superior and inferior transverse torus, never found in modern humans and only in very muted form in Homo erectus. Okay, so that's whatever that is. It's not going down the Homo erectus in modern human terms. Furthermore, the hobbits had oversized arms and feet like chimps. Body proportions are more like Homo habilis or Australophilicus than Homo erectus, explains Argue. The latest analysis places the hobbit as most likely a sister species to Homo habilis, which lived in Africa around 1.75 million years ago. Okay. How, then, did such a primitive hominid get to Florida from Africa, a journey across water more than 190,000 years ago? If a relative of habilis did make it out of Africa, how come no other remains have been found along the way? One way out of the quandary is to suggest that Homo erectus arrived in the island and reverted back to primitive form. Argue finds this implausible. Why would the jaw of Homo erectus evolve back to the primitive condition? Ultimately, it's a case of more questions than answers. Okay. Probably a little bit, you'd have to know about the habilis, and the, it'd be nice if you had a timeline with it. Okay, this one is, when black holes collide, and this is the last one I'll do for this talk, because I'm going into 15 minutes. When black holes collide, new evidence from gravitational waves emerges after a head-on smash involving black holes, Richard A. Lovett reports. Scientists have observed one of the most powerful astronomical events ever seen, a collision of two giant black holes to form an even larger black hole. Perhaps you would mention that and a gravitational wave coming out of it, equal to several solar masses. It's the third time since 2015 that such a collision has been observed by an instrument called, in the US, called the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, which consists of a pair of detectors, one in Hammerford, I'd say a pair of telescopes, because there's two detectors in each one. One detector lens in Hannaford and Washington, and the other in Livingston, Louisiana, each designed to measure gravitational waves from distant cosmological events. Gravitational waves are ripples in the fabric of space created by the movements of massive objects approaching the speed of light, you would also want to mention. And normally we are accelerating towards the speed of light. Normally we don't think of space as having any properties at all, so it's counterintuitive, says Michael Landry, director of LIGO's Hanford Observatory. Nevertheless, he says, Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts that space can expand, contract, or vibrate, thereby distorting the medium in which we all live. Okay. I don't like doing the general relativity to work this one out. This is 16 ranked tenses and all that type of stuff. Okay. 4 ranked tenses with 64 components. Okay. These waves can be measured, he adds, because the distortions they produce look like changes in the length of any object they pass through. Landry compares it to stretching a canvas of a painting. If I stretch the medium, the painting gets distorted. That's a really good analogy, isn't it? In the latest case, LIGO saw a rapidly vibrating distortion produced as two black holes spiraled towards each other before merging. The energy thus released from in the form of gravitational waves was equivalent to two sun-sized stars being dematerialized in one-third of a second. That's good. I understand that, but that is probably not a good statement to get across. Once the collision was complete, the black hole had a mass about 50 times that of our sun. It's important to find because it suggests that black holes of this size may be fairly common. Before our discoveries, we didn't even know for sure these black holes existed, said Laura Lara Cadonati of Georgia Tech University. We know that they do. They have played an important role in the early universe. The new finding allowed researchers to calculate whether the colliding black holes were spinning in the same direction as they circled each other before the collision. Imagine two tornadoes rotating each other. It says Laura Condotti of Georgia Tech University. They could be in the same orbit or opposed or at any angle in between. Okay. Computer modeling showed that the signals directed LIGO contained gravitational fingerprints of black holes that with spins that did not align with their orbit. Calenti says this favors the theory that these two black holes formed separately and then paired up rather than being formed from the collapse of two already paired stars. Well, that's a really interesting thing. The research is published in the PhysRev A. Okay, thanks for listening. I'll stop and I'll get ready another batch.